Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Eric.
Welcome to this workshop. We will go to noon. We'll take a break until 1. Come back till 3:30. We'll take a coffee break halfway through the morning, coffee break halfway through in the afternoon. If you have to go up, just feel free. Bathrooms are down there. I think that's it in terms of hardware. I'm doing this to say thanks for all the board members, all the people who have worked to put together the Friends of Young. I don't really care to get involved in the hardware stuff, so what I do is donate my time and do this workshop as a way to kind of give some energy back for all the work the board members have done and all the people who kept this organization afloat. This is the beginning of a series where we'll be examining Jung's major works. If you look on the back of the study guide, there's a URL, and you'll find more information about the other programs at that URL. Basically, we're going to do two more this school year, so to speak, between now and, well, actually next month. We're going to do Mystery and Kniepionis, and then we're going to do two in the fall, and then two more in the following spring, so that we've done...
I was looking at you.
On the very back. I'll explain a little bit more what I mean by Jung's major works in a second. There's going to be a leitmotif running through these six workshops, and that is the evolution of Jung's concept of the self. That's really his main contribution to psychology, and it is certainly the most difficult part of his material to understand. I'm going to assume that you know the basics. Anima, shadow, so this is not a beginning level, it's not exactly advanced, I'd say it's intermediate, and we'll build then on that knowledge. And as I said, the self is a little bit more difficult than those basic concepts, so that's going to be what occupies us throughout. We're going to start with volume 5. Which is the book that Jung wrote in 1912. It's the book that occasioned his break with Freud. By 1912, Jung was 37, and he had finished his college, he had finished his medical training, and he had finished his psychiatric training. So he was a psychiatrist working in the, what would have been like Central State, maybe, the state mental hospital of this, the canton, which would be like our state, of Zurich. It's a bit weird because he really isn't Jung yet. He doesn't get to be Jung until kind of later. He is still under the sway of his work with Freud. He met Freud in 1907, studied with Freud until 1912. So just the beginning ideas of Jung are in this book. And I debated which one to start with. I decided to start with this one, even though it really isn't the most interesting of all the things he's written. And it's certainly not the richest book that he wrote, but it lays the foundation. So it'll get more interesting, although I think hopefully you'll find this book is interesting as well. But what we'll be doing is looking at, you know, what are his basic principles? What differentiates him from Freud? He lays all of this out in this book. And then at occasion they're split. So hopefully by focusing on that, we will be able to then have laid, sort of dug the basement, and then we can build on top of that for the next five meetings. Because then after that, the self comes in. After a split with Freud, which happened right after this book, he went into a 15-year period of, I call it a psychological pregnancy, despair, whatever you want to call it. He really had lost a very valued friend and teacher in Freud, even though he couldn't stomach Freud's fundamental approach. So the next 15 years were spent inwardly looking and coming up with what we now call Jungian psychology, which was completed, he had his idea straight by 1928. And that's what he developed in that period of 15 years, is the self. So that what we'll be working on then in the next books, which are all later Jung, we'll be focusing on that concept that he developed, which really distinguishes himself from the Freudian position. I'll give you a quick taste of what those other workshops are going to be, and give you a quick taste of what the other ideas are that he developed along the way. The workshop in February is going to be on alchemy. And alchemy is the main text Jung went to, the symbolism of alchemy, to understand what the self is, how it works. Basically, the way it works is it synthesizes opposites. This may not make sense now. It will, hopefully, by the time everything's done. By the way, what I consider the major works, we've jumped from 1912 to 1928 to 1944. 1944, Jung had a heart attack. And he began kind of rewriting all of his main ideas from the age of 69, which is what he was in 1944, until his death in 1961 when he was 86. So the works we're going to be looking at are all the works written at the end of his life, whereby he summarizes all the things he had discovered by 1928, but then slowly refined until the end of his life, and then gave a final exposition of what those ideas were. So these major writings then started in 1944. He had been working on alchemy all along, all his life, but he really summarized his thoughts in that book, Mysterium Quintionis. Don't worry about the title. And by the way, all this stuff is on the website too, what these are. In his study of the symbolism of alchemy, another big source that he went to for understanding the dynamics of the self will be Gnosticism. And that's what he wrote up in his book, Ion. We'll talk about that in the fall of next year. Also, how he saw the self operative in Western history since the birth of Christ. That will be the first thing in the fall of 07. The next main source that Jung went to for understanding how the self worked is the Book of Job. And we'll look then in the second workshop in the fall of the next school year, will be the relationship with the Book of Job to Jung's concept of the self, and how that applies to people who have been the victims of evil and violence. It's really Jung's attempt to understand how we heal, strangely heal, through trauma. Then going to the spring, the winter spring of 08, we'll look at the role of lust and hate in the dynamics of the self, and particularly as that plays itself out in what we call in psychology transference, the relationship between the therapist and the client. The last one will be the winter spring of 08, will be on synchronicity. One of the things that Jung had to reckon with as he looked at the way the self functions in us is that it breaks all the known laws of Western science. And that, or phenomena occur which break all the known laws, or certainly are not accountable by the known laws of Western science. So we'll look at synchronicity, its challenge to Western science, and its challenge to theology. So that will take us through spring of 08. But today we start with a rather prosaic work, Symbols of Transformation, as I said, written in 1912, in which he lays his foundations, his foundational ideas. He never really changes these, although he certainly does build upon them. What's this book about in a nutshell? Well, Jung got a hold of a text by an American woman that he calls Miss Miller. Miss Miller was a student at the University of Geneva in Switzerland. And she recorded her fantasies and her dreams and some poetry she wrote in her journal. These were published quite independent of Jung. Jung had nothing to do with this, by a man named Theodor Flournoy. We'll talk about him in a minute. After returning from Europe, she had a schizophrenic break. And so what Jung did was go to her material and interpret it to show the psychological processes that were going on in her as manifest in her journal writings. So that's what this book is. The book is an interpretation of only about 5 or 6 pages of her journal writing. There are 2 levels in the book, and now I'm anticipating how the book's a little confusing. Part of the intent of the book is simply for him to analyze and understand her journal writings. So part of the book is about her. But that's not the larger import of the book. The larger purpose of the book is using those writings to show how he understands what happens inside human beings in general psychologically. And then to contrast his way of understanding it with the way Freud would understand it. So he takes an objective text, somebody he doesn't know, he interprets it, we'll see a lot about what's ticking inside of her, and then he will go a step further and examine how all of that is typical of the way he sees what makes people work. Another thing that he does in the book, which will be confusing, and hopefully we can get it clear as we go along, is he is operating on 2 levels. He will again and again refer to Freud, and he will refer to Freud's ideas literally, and then he will refer to their value as metaphors. This will be something we'll have to get straight. It may not make sense now. Hopefully it will by the end of the day. He never really throws out Freud ever in his work. What he does is say Freud's work is true on a certain level, understood a certain way, it makes sense. And the way he understands it is as metaphor. We'll be talking all about that. So we'll be juggling between layers, and I think this is one of the puzzles of the book, and you can so easily get lost. Now, what layer am I at? And I'll try to keep bringing you, okay, here's where we are, here's where we are, here's where we are. He's doing 2 things. He's talking about a woman's, as we say in my field, prodromal phase, the beginning phase of a psychosis. He's talking about her material, and he's using her material to explicate his ideas. So there's 2 things going on. And then he goes to Freud again and again to show how Freud would interpret it, and then how he would interpret how Freud interprets it. Again, never throwing it out, what Freud says, but recasting it in a larger light. I've done this material with a group before, never in a day workshop, so for me, doing something like this for the first time in a short period always raises the question of timing. I'm not quite sure how the timing is going to work, whether we will have gobs of material, whether we will have enough time, so that's sort of the unknown. But for the present, until we see kind of where we're going, I'm going to ask, I don't mind if you ask questions, you can stop me and ask questions, but keep your questions to the point of, I don't understand, what's he mean? If you have questions, I don't agree with him, or what are the implications, make a note. If we have time at the end of the workshop, we can go to those questions, but I don't want to spend our time now, is he really saying, or I don't agree with that, or that will, I'm afraid, limit the ability to transmit knowledge. My real purpose today is to transmit what is in that book. When I do seminars with folks privately, I'm more than happy to have discussions of the nature of, I don't agree, he's full of crap, or what's he really saying there, but I don't think it would be appropriate for an introductory material today. So jot him down. If there's time, we will come back to him. In a way, it's perhaps silly to even try to undertake this venture. All of the books that we're doing, I've done with study groups before, and we spent anywhere from 40 to 100 hours on them. So we've got 4.5 probably by the time we include breaks to do this book. And so it's really kind of an introduction to an introduction. But I hope at least to be able to give you a grasp of the major points in Jung's work. And what I hope to do is really inspire you to start reading Jung yourself. Jungians are great, but Jung is better. And for each of the books we'll be talking about, there is a study guide itself, which I will recommend. And most of them are done by Edinger. I think all of them are done by Edinger. The study guide to this book is called Transformation of Libido by Edward Edinger. It's privately published, and it's available at the Jung Institute in Los Angeles at their bookstore. And I think their website is Jung in LA. If you Google Jung in LA, it'll come up. I recommend, when reading Jung, first read the study guide. What I'm doing is going to hopefully give you enough to read this to make sense. When you read this, it will hopefully give you enough to have that make sense. So that's my motivation. And again, I think reading Jung is such a delight. Picking this book up and rereading it reminded me I bought it 30 years ago at Moe's Bookshop in Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, California. And preparing this class I had the same excitement reading this book 30 years later that I had reading it 30 years earlier. It's that rich. And I think you will see it is difficult. I'm not here to tell you it's easy. It's not easy stuff, but it is worth it. We can talk more about why it's worth it as we go along. So if you're ready, let's go to the study guide and hear a little bit about what Jung says concerning the subject of this material. What we'll be doing now for the rest of the day, I've tried to go through the book and just give you the main ideas in the book. We'll read them and we'll talk about them. We'll read them and talk about them, trying to get the cream of Jung's message, and also with me giving you some guidance, hopefully, how to read what's in between. But the first two quotes are not from Symbols of Transformation. They're from a book called Analytical Psychology. It's available if you want it. It's not the most interesting thing Jung wrote, but he does talk about the writing of this book. So I started off with two paragraphs. And I'll read you pretty much what I've already told you. He calls her Miss Frank Miller, an American student at the University of Geneva, wrote a memoir describing her fantasies, Some Instances of Subconscious Creative Imagination, published in French in the Archive de Psychologie, Geneva, volume blah, 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 with an introduction by the psychologist Theodore Flournoy, who was treating her. And then he says, as a matter of fact, Miss Miller did afterwards become entirely deranged. During the war, I had a letter from the man who was Miss Miller's doctor in America telling me that my analysis of her fantasy material had been a perfectly correct one, that in her insanity, the cosmogonic myths, I mean the world-creating myths, touched upon had come fully to light. Also, Flournoy, who had come under observation at the time I first read her material, told me that my analysis had been correct. There was such a tremendous activity of the collective unconscious that it was not surprising that she was finally overcome. In the foreword, he writes the following. This material was originally published by my respected and fatherly friend, the late Theodore Flournoy. I had the great satisfaction of hearing from his own lips that I had hit off the young woman's mentality very well. Valuable confirmation of this reached me in 1918 through an American colleague who was treating Miss Miller for the schizophrenic disturbance which had broken out after her sojourn in Europe. He wrote to say that my exposition of the case was so exhaustive that even personal acquaintance with the patient had not taught him one iota more about her mentality. This confirmation led me to conclude that my reconstruction of the semi-conscious and unconscious fantasy processes had evidently hit the mark in all essential respects. So that's Miss Miller.
Gary, how old was she?
He tells us, I think, younger than 30.
She was young.
Yeah, she was young. Yeah. Because some of these occur on the boat as she was going to Geneva to go to school. I will try to summarize. By the way, there are two parts of the book, named surprisingly Part 1 and Part 2, and we're going to pick up with Chapter 2 of Part 1, and I will just try to summarize what's in there. And it is a good way to get us going and to get us realizing we are not only learning new material, we are learning a new way of thinking about new material. And that's what I want to spend a little time on. what is Jung's method and why is it his method? Because if you don't understand that, you just think he's talking in circles. He is talking in circles, but he's talking in circles for a reason. The story that will sum up Chapter 2 and Part 1 was told to me by one of my teachers. Some of you may have heard this, so bear with me. But my teacher was a British fellow who was an Oxford-trained linguist. And right out of college, he took a job as the district commissioner in Basutoland. Basutoland is a protectorate. I think it's changed its name. I forget what it's called now. But it's its own little country now. It was a protectorate within South Africa. It's surrounded by South Africa. And it's a country of Aboriginal peoples. And my friend, well, my teacher, being a linguist, learned the Basuto language. And he said that one day he was sitting around on a Saturday afternoon talking with the Basuto chief. And he said to the Basuto chief, can you describe to me the difference between yourself and myself? What's the difference between a white man and, as they call themselves, brown people? What's the difference between a white man and a brown person? Can you tell me? And the chief said, oh yes, that's easy. You think in thoughts and we think in pictures. Jung's approach to the psyche is going back to that original thought process of human society, which does not think logically, but thinks imagistically. So Jung writes not logically, but imagistically. And that's a shift we have to get used to. I was trained first in science, and then I was trained in theology. And if you think science is linear, you ought to try theology. I had a heck of a time learning this new language. It is really learning another language. What's the difference? Well, in normal logic, you go from point A to point B to point C. And that's the way our minds have been trained through our Western education to function. But with symbolic thinking, you don't go in a straight line. You go in a circle around a common image. So you'll see Jung start with an image. We'll talk about the hero, for example, today. And I'll be talking about the hero in Egypt. And I'll be talking about the hero in Turkey. And then he'll be saying, well, not only do heroes show up as heroes, sometimes they show up as sons. So pretty soon he'll be talking about the sun. And then he'll say, well, sun is fire. Another way that the hero shows up is that it's represented by fire. So if you are thinking, how in the hell did we get from Osiris to fire, you'll be lost if you don't realize that what is guiding the thought is each thought's relationship back to a central point. They don't link up this way. They link up this way. So we will be using this symbolic thought process, which is, of course, is the way the dream puts things to us, to try to grasp the nature of her unconscious imagery that's coming up in these fantasies, poetries, and dreams. So Jung has adjusted his methodology of inquiry to the nature of the material he's trying to understand. So the book begins with this description of two types of thinking to warn us. He is going to be indulging in the second type of thinking to warn us what's coming, not to try to understand this linearly and to understand it circularly, in a circular fashion, or symbolically. If you read people who criticize Jung, you will read very often the comment that he's unclear and he's woolly-headed. He is not unclear and he's not woolly-headed. He is just not working this way. He's working this way. And he's working this way intentionally. If you read his early stuff, way, way before even Symbols of Transformation, which is, you know, really of no use unless you're a historian or doing research in early Jung for some particular reason, it's very linear. But it's useless for understanding the dreams, so he has changed his method. So you're going to have to shift your way of thinking. Don't be surprised if it's frustrating. It took me years to learn this. We will be working on two levels, her material and its general meaning, and we'll be working on two levels, Freud literally and Freud metaphorically. So I think if you're aware of those three distinctions, those three pairs of possibilities, it will make the reading a lot simpler. What we will do now is look at, I think I brought along three, I tried to pick out the most pregnant texts in her memoirs, and we'll look at what her text is, and then we'll start investigating how Jung discussed it. So the first, and maybe before we do that, I don't know if this is going to make it better or worse, but I thought before we get into a series of ideas, I would try to summarize the main ideas so you kind of know what's coming. And the main idea that we're going to see presented in chapter 4 of part 1 is really the main idea, one of the main ideas in the book, is that she has an erotic feeling. And she begins talking about the Father God. And Jung is trying to understand, how do you make this, how do we understand the fact that she is probably charged with a sexual fantasy, and what she talks about is father. Well, you see, Freud would go ape over something like that. And Jung is going to look at his way of understanding that. So here's the situation then that comes out of. She writes in her journal, on the ship to Geneva. Do you guys have a... one of the officers, singing at night as he stood watch on a deck, had made a great impression on me and had given me the idea of writing some words that could be fitted to his melody. And then this is the poem. This is Jung. She goes through different versions of it. I've just tried to simplify it and give you the final version.
This is the fancy.
The first event happened, and then the second one is a poem that she says more or less was dictated to her. Mm-hmm. She heard it inside herself more than consciously created it. And this is her poem, the final verse. When the eternal first made sound, a myriad ears sprang out to hear. And throughout all the universe, there rolled an echo deep and clear, all glory to the God of sound. When the eternal first made light, a myriad eyes sprang out to look. And hearing ears and seeing eyes, once more a mighty choral took, all glory to the God of light. When the eternal first gave love, a myriad hearts sprang into life. Ears filled with music, eyes with light. Filled forth with hearts, with love all rife, all glory to the God of love. So the detail that Jung is going to explore now at considerable depth is what's the relationship between her being impressed by this handsome Italian ship's mate and the fantasy of a father god. Yes.
I mean, based on this, can I just ask you why the idea that it's the Father God? I mean, why did this ever think Father God?
Because it's reminiscent of the creation myth in the Old Testament. He creates light. He creates the world. Jung writes, when an impression is denied conscious recognition, it reverts to an earlier form of relationship. Now that is the Freudian position. The idea is that she had an attraction to a man, but that attraction wasn't conscious. So the energy that would have gone into fulfilling that attraction falls back into the individual and activates the earlier form of relationship that connection would have been a evolution of, namely the father. So what Freud would say is that the poem was a substitute wish fulfillment for her desire for that man. Now, Jung is going to go from there. The idea of a masculine creator god is apparently derived from the father imago. An aim is, among other things, at replacing the infantile relation to the father in such a way as to enable the individual to emerge from the narrow circle of the family into the wider circle of society. Let me try to graph what the difference between what Jung is saying and what Freud is saying. A woman has an attraction. And her energy is moving toward that attraction. But it reaches a block. Now, we got to put a big question here. What is the nature of that block? We'll be talking about that. For whatever reason, she doesn't go up to the guy and say, "Hi, you want to stop by and see my etchings?" Instead, she writes a poem. So the energy from that doesn't go to the object of her desire and falls into the unconscious, where it activates, says Freud, her earlier experience of man, and that creates the poem. So that the poem, as I said, is a substitute for that wish. And the reason the poem speaks of father is because that's the relationship that energy falls back to. What Jung is saying is there's something else going on. And the book is going to be pursuing this idea now from here to the end. That this father is merely the language by which an image is created that she is aware of in her poem. And rather than substitute for her desire, it actually takes the energy that she didn't deal with and reframes it for her in another form. For the purpose of taking her energy into the future. I'll let that sink in. That's the main idea of the book. Is everybody okay with that? For Freud, this image is a substitute. For what she didn't realize on the ship's deck. For Jung, it's a bridge from one state of mind to another state of mind, the nature of which we don't yet know. And the presence of the father imagery, is it? Because she is substituting a father fantasy to satisfy her desire for the man. It's because there is, now here comes Jung's addition, a completely new dimension to human motivation that Freud excludes. And that is that these images don't serve to substitute for desire, but they serve to transform.
Is it Jung's thinking that he can get blocked and not go further from just the...
Well, we're going to see Jung still recognizes that she's blocked. But where he is going to take the block isn't that she doesn't recognize what she was feeling and that this is a substitute, which tells her she should recognize what she was feeling, which would be the Freudian approach. She gets stuck because she becomes fascinated with this image rather than understand what it means. It ends up for her pathological, but the nature of this process is itself healthy. For Freud, this is a pathological process. You don't know what you want. Your energy activates a substitute image of what you want, and that satisfies the original disregarded longing. But for Jung, this process isn't substituting for anything. It's generating, and we're going to be looking at this a lot today, what's happening down here. It's generating the possibility of future life if you know how to work with it. Another way to put this is, for Freud, these images in her fantasies are symptoms. For Jung, they're symbols. For Freud, they point back to the past. For Jung, they point toward the future. That's just the basic idea. We're going to work it again and again and again, but I wanted to give you the summary, just so you know basically what we're talking about.
Can you say that again? For Freud, the images are symptoms?
Are symptoms. It's a symptom that she has denied a mature relationship and is satisfied with a substitute parental relationship.
Right.
And Jung is a symbol that her future is being announced to her in this experience if only she knows how to read it. Jung is going to now go to great lengths to try to show us what's going on here that Freud missed, and then how do you understand it up here so that you don't get stuck. That's a lot of the book.
So he basically says that Freud was onto something here, but he didn't quite get all of it.
Yeah. I would say that he takes Freud to his logical conclusion. Yeah. He never disregards these basic assumptions of Freud. He just says there's a chapter two after chapter one.
Yeah.
And is that the difference, Gary, between it sinking back into the personal unconscious versus tapping into the collective? Is that also when the foot began to show?
You could say, see, for Freud, this is in her because of her relationship to her dad. Jung is going to say, no, this is an intrinsic factor of human nature, which you're born with. We'll talk more about that. That's another whole point. Where does that come from? How does it work? But yes.
Are you going to talk just briefly about the difference between how Freud and Jung would try to treat the patient somewhere down the road? You don't have to answer.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, I think you can just see it right now. What the Freudian would have done is tried to get her to see how she is how she is not acting on her desire for the world because of her relationship to her father, or influenced by her relationship to her father. And Jung is going to be saying, what is this experience asking of you?
Jung would say that the father just sort of triggered the intrinsic stuff that was already there in the woman. In the same way that,
right.
that
yes.
the soldier did.
Yeah, this is a trigger.
Yeah.
Right. We're going to see, Jung does make a distinction that whether this is a repression, if it's a repression, he's not so likely to disagree with Freud, that it could be a substitute. He's always willing to say what Freud is saying could be true. Yet, if it's not a repression, he doesn't think if it's a suppression. And again, I'm jumping way ahead now. If it's not repressed but suppressed, if she is not stuck in swearing this isn't happening, but just something else is going on in her mind. Then he wants to add another dimension to the experience. Well, that's the basic idea, so make sure you're happy with that, because we're just going to embellish that now for the rest of the day. I'm trying to think how to do this. Actually, what I've done, I've just gone along with the text, and I was going to try to organize ideas, but I thought, he's not linear, why should I? So we're going to be jumping from this to this to this to this, but we're always going to be working around this basic thing. And he kind of drops this hint now, and he'll develop it later. Where did she go wrong? Well, we don't necessarily see in this text where she goes wrong, but we will later. But anticipating, he says, what she does is she gets stuck at associations which bring the underlying complex to life only in indirect, as we will see, dangerous way. Meaning, her poem doesn't give her any insight into its meaning. And she stays stuck on the aesthetic appreciation of the poem and doesn't ask herself, how is that a symbol? So what happens in the long run is not unlike a way a Freudian would understand it. She does get stuck in this experience, but the production of the experience isn't the thing that's pathological. It's her not being able to interpret it as pathological. She becomes dazzled by her own creation and slowly removes herself from reality through being dazzled by it. But again, Jung does not want to say its presence is wrong, it's her attitude towards it that's wrong.
Is this being stuck on the archetype, what he said Nietzsche was?
Yes. Yeah. Now, Jung is going to talk about this down here in terms of the archetype pretty soon. So we're going to broaden that quite a bit. This is wrong. This is Jung still a third Freud. He's going to enlarge that quite a bit.
So Gary, this is just another level of blockage, in a way, by being dazzled or stuck.
Yes, yeah, yeah. It's not that she's not blocked. It's that what she's blocked on isn't a pathological symptom. It's an attempt to heal that she can't process. Next one, paragraph 78. By the way, Jung's works are divided into paragraphs, so that's why I all the collected works. And also, by the way, this is, I'm pretty sure this is available in paperback. I saw somebody had it in paperback.
Right here.
Yeah, you've got it. I think it's still in print. So, referring now to this. Jung says, we must take that moment, meaning the moment of the creation of the poem, whereby that image becomes clear to her, as foreshadowing a future life aim. That's what Jung means by a symbol, pointing to the future. Okay, now the next one's kind of hard. By the devious root of the father-imago relationship. Now, this word father-imago. Is a forerunner to his word archetype. It's not quite the same as saying father-image. I don't know if this is going to make it better or worse for you, but by father-imago, you could almost say the father image creating process. That's what he means by imago, a process, whereby images are created. So by the Father creating image process, you might say, the night watching singer becomes the creator, the God of sound, of light, and of love. That should make sense, right? That's what we said. Okay with that? Now, here he's differing with Freud. This is not to say that the idea of God derives from the loss of a lover and is nothing but a substitute for the human object. Does that make sense? That would be the Freudian position, that this is present because she didn't know what she wanted, and this is what created a substitute for what she wanted, so that all this God stuff in her is simply because she doesn't know what she wants. What is evidently in question here is the displacement of libido or energy onto a symbolical object. It is a perfectly genuine experience, though, like everything else, it can be put to improper use. So the displacement of libido onto a symbolic object, what is really going on in this moment is that her desirousness is being transformed into a symbol by way of this process that creates images.
Is the symbol the father, or the poem?
Yes, yes. And the symbol creating process is that process in ourselves that changes the desire into an image, changes the instinct into an image. And again, we're going to say a lot more about this. And what I'm actually saying now, I'm going to be contradicting myself a little later. But we're just following the way he lays it out. This is he's trying to speak in the Freudian jargon until he establishes his point, and he'll change his language more towards what he really means.
So he's changing his outlook as he's writing this. He's evolving as he's
I think he is. Yes, I really do think he is. Yeah.
Well, plus, this text was revised.
Yes. The text that was originally written, I bought it. I actually have the first edition. I don't know where I got it. Somehow I got a copy of it. Here's what it looks like. It was published, as I said, in 1912. And here's the faceplate on the page. I was going to bring it along, but it's falling apart. And I don't want to subject it to any more wear and tear. It was written in 1912. And it was rewritten in 1952 or 1951. We're doing the 51 version. 1912 is really quite antiquated. So people have always asked me, what's the main difference? And I have not ever gone through the two and compared them, although that would be an interesting project sometime if I ever have some time to go through paragraph by paragraph. But yes, I think he is writing this book saying, I can't agree with Freud. I can't quite know why, I don't quite know why, but I'm going to try to work it out.
So as he's writing these things down, he's seeing.
I think he's seeing. He's seeing what he's saying. Right. Yeah, because he's not going to say this at all. And you'll see he comes back to saying it just this way, and then he goes back and he says it the other way. And if you don't know that, you will really get confused. It's really sort of a book to himself, I think. Yeah.
Here he has a creative process, that's how we all write.
It's right.
Just, you know, just trying to get it out there and objectify
what he's got. Yeah. His other books are not particularly clear either, but they're unclear in a different way. He does have his mind made up, but here he's really grasping. Yeah.
Formulate.
Really trying to formulate. And it wasn't until 1928 that this becomes clear. This is the part which is going to be changed completely in the later Jung. Here it's very simple. It's not so simple in the later Jung. But let's worry about the complicated stuff when we got the basics down.
So, in terms of you don't know how to focus on the relationship that they school has with the father?
Nope. Big difference. Yes. Big difference. If he could see that this relationship to her father wasn't a complete taboo to her, if every question he ever asked her about her dad hit a brick wall, then he would switch to the Freudian approach. Again, he's not saying this can never be a substitute, but where there isn't a brick wall between the man and his mom or the woman and her father, when, you know, she could have been aware of it, but she wasn't aware of it, that it is not a repression, then he would work this way. Right. And you will hear, you hear pretty quickly whether the person can see the parent, talk about the parent, or whether it's a brick wall. I've told that story of one situation where I was talking to a woman whose father used to come home and pull out a .357 Magnum and point it at the kids' heads and scream and yell at him, he's going to blow their brains out. And police would be called, there would be a big scene. I heard the story several times, and finally it just flew out of my mouth. I said, "What? Bastard." And she said, "Oh, no, he was a very nice man. He just had bad days."
Yeah.
See, when you hear that kind of denial, then you're okay. But if she would have said, "Oh, yeah, he was horrible, and we've suffered, and we're still trying to get over it," no. She already knows. Why pursue it more? Then you pursue it this way.
So you're saying there would be times that a person would need a Freudian
yes.
analyst, not a Jungian.
Well, where we do...
Freudian first, and then...
Yeah, where we do go back to the past, and we do use Freud's method of taking events and looking at their cause, And, you know, to be realistic about it, I think what one does is a balance. We all have spots where we're blocked about the past, and then you have to go back. But where you can see there is no blockage to the past, then what's the point of pursuing it more? You already know your dad was an SOB. You know, why pursue that more? And as you will see, Jung feels that that's misusing psychology to deny your responsibility for the present. You can deny the past just as much as you can deny the present, and vice versa. Paragraph 90. As we have seen, the religious hymn unconsciously produced by Miss Miller appears in place of the erotic problem. It derives its material for the most part from reminiscences which were reactivated by the introverted libido. Does that make sense? Introverted libido. The energy which didn't flow out. I would prefer to find out the meaning and purpose of the apparently devious path followed by the libido and of the apparent self-perception. The key words there are meaning and purpose. Yes, this stuff down here has a role in experiencing what was not experienced with the man. However, Jung doesn't want to say this is the cause of the experience. He simply wants to say this is what gives the experience its form. And what interests me is not what gives it its form or why, but where the form that it is given wants her to go. We'll, you know, a whole section of the book is devoted to where he thinks it wants her to go. Well, I think he's speaking tongue-in-cheek there. Yep. No. I think he's speaking to the Freudian who would be saying, there's something sneaky going on here. And he's really saying, tongue-in-cheek, no, there's not. Now, on the two ways of looking at it, granting validity to both, and then trying to distinguish which way we want to work. If her creation is based on an act of repression, so we call this unknown here a repression. That is, if she would be saying, no, my dad was just a nice guy, even though he tried to shoot me. Then the picture of the Father God is a projection, and the procedure responsible for this, a self-deceiving maneuver undertaken for the illegitimate purpose of making real a real difficulty unreal, that is, of juggling it out of existence. So he's acknowledging the validity of looking at it as a substitute under some circumstances. If, however, a product like the hymn came into being without an act of repression, that is, unconsciously and spontaneously. Remember, Freud thought that everything in the unconscious was there because it was repressed, and Jung felt there could be an activity of the unconscious separate from any cause of things being put there by repression. If, however, a product like the hymn came into being without an act of repression, that is, unconsciously and spontaneously, then the Creator God who emerges from the Father Imago is no longer a product of repression or a substitute, but a natural and inevitable phenomenon. That's what we've been saying. Anything you want to hash over there?
In actuality, is that difficult to figure out whether working with somebody, whether it's a repression or not?
I'd say there are times when it's crystal clear, like the situation I mentioned. One way, and it's crystal clear when the people are open to talking about it, yes, I think there are some gray areas. Personally, I think when in doubt, this is the way to go first. Looking at, is there a cause at work here for something that you're not aware of? But when that then leads nowhere, or you understand the cause but nothing changes, then try to see if there's a future purpose. Another sentence which describes the image, that it's a teleological orientation in which the cause anticipates the goal. Want to try to put that in your own words?
I was hoping you would. That's a synchronicity.
We're not at synchronicity yet, but we're getting close.
That's not what's taking it down.
Mm-hmm.
That is for you.
Can you put that in a Jung 201 language?
That the future is affecting the present.
Yes. What he's saying is, it isn't that the past always is affecting the present, but the future is perhaps causing this situation to get itself known by virtue of this symbol creating process. So the past doesn't cause the present, the future causes the present.
Could you also say that the self has rung you up and you answered the phone?
Because, in other words, the self is always got a leading edge. And on that day, she crossed that leading edge, you know, almost like a field, like a bowel wave.
Yeah.
And the energy that was released then got processed by her into that image. And your choice is, do I wake up, do I recognize this as a bowel wave, or do I shut it down?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, at this time, without fearing about there being no time, or if half of the future of all one, is that in existence? Do you know how to look at that?
I don't know.
There's a lot that we can have here, but it was, if, and maybe Jung was touching on that in his own process.
I don't know. I can tell you my more subtle answer to that question. See, this is 1912. I think he had met Einstein by this time. I think Einstein was living in Zurich. And they were having dinners and coffees together. But this is not Einstein's physics. This is more quantum physics. And Jung hadn't met in fact, quantum physics hadn't even been developed until 1927. So those ideas weren't around. But are you interested in this? I don't want to get us too far off. I'll mention it briefly, because I think we're doing okay with our time. I would say that there's a fundamental shift trying to occur in Western consciousness at two places in the same time. One of them was in Zurich and one of them was in Copenhagen. They didn't discuss it in parallel at the time, but you can definitely see that Jung's overturning of Freud's causality is parallel with quantum physics disregarding Newton's causality. And where Freud is based on the Newtonian cause and effect model, Jung is based on the quantum non-cause and effect model. We could go off forever on that, but that might be enough of an answer for our purposes. Yeah. And I do think Jungian psychology, which is why I can stay interested in it, it is really an attempt to respond to the shift in Western mentality. It's not just about how do you fix people, it's how do we need to shift to understand ourselves to become more in touch with where this paradigm is evolving in many different areas? So causality is like with physics, it is valid under some circumstances, but under other circumstances, it's not a valid principle of interpretation. And that's true for physics, and that's true for Jung.
If he's saying then that the future causes the present, how about the future effect on the past?
But that's even a bigger question. Yeah. I think we have to entertain that as a possibility, that events in the past are preparations for steps in the future that are somewhere known. Yes, I do think that. Yeah.
In my life, my experience has been is that when the future calls on me and I process it consciously, then there's a big shift in the past. It takes that conscious processing. It's just left in that kind of floating thing in the future. Nothing happens. But I've had very dramatic things happen literally with people who were dead when the stuff got processed and consciously in the present.
Yeah. And that may be the final healing that in looking at this relationship between present and future, the past is re-experienced, and we're free from it.
So are you saying that if you're fully aware of what is happening in this future, and re-looking at the things that have brought it to be, then you have a different opinion about the past, and that's what changes the past, is that you've changed your opinion, your perspective.
Yes, absolutely. I wouldn't say always, but certainly under certain circumstances. So what you thought was your greatest cross, you realized, well, without that, I wouldn't be here.
You wouldn't be you.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be in the position of having this challenge, which I am now blossoming through. Very weird.
But Gary, isn't part of that idea that because you're working in images, not thoughts, it's not a shift in your opinion as much as it is your energetic experience of it? I mean, you can rethink your past and have an insight to it, but it doesn't really change anything.
Yeah.
You still feel, it's like it's not in your cells yet.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think, when I hear what Kathy was saying and what Jess was saying, it's like you literally have a different experience of the past, not just a different thought.
Mm-hmm. The experience in the present changes the experience of the past.
Completely. And, yeah. and it feels like mm-hmm. you've experienced the past differently.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that you think about it or you have a different opinion about it.
Yeah. Yep.
And that's where the image, I think, is just...
And that's where the healing really can take place.
Uh-huh. So you're carrying it a step further.
Well, the image is charged with energy, and that is what shifts. It is my understanding of it versus just your thinking about it, which is just a linear, rational experience of it, but doesn't necessarily change anything.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, yes.
Is it also similar to the remembering of the affect?
Yeah. Yes. The intelligent character of this unconscious activity can hardly be denied. A man's spiritual vocation, in the widest sense, is thrust upon him by the unconscious. So, you see, he's kind of stepping back from what he's been saying and seeing that this process is the process that really tells us who we are. And who we are is something that is given to us through these experiences. We create ourselves insofar as we accept what is given and we make it real, but we don't create ourselves in the sense that we just think something up and put it into reality. If you're living, trying to live this process, these experiences are presented. And so to call them pathological and wish fulfillments and substitute expressions lames the whole future creating capacity of our inner life that is trying to communicate to us who we are and where we're going.
Well, according to you, in this way, there is information for us to get out of the situation.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's no information. No.
It's just a repressed.
Yeah. It's just a repressed. Yeah.
That's why he's calling it intelligence.
Why he's calling it?
Intelligence.
Yes, we're going to be making more of that. Now, he doesn't really take that much further than that now, but this is what the self is. The self is that personification of your inborn identity that intelligently knows where your life can go. Now, he hasn't developed that idea yet. And the other thing, just to let you know where this material will be going in the future, here he presents it as kind of a neat little, the unconscious gives you something, and you take it up, and you listen, and then you go forward. Sometimes it does, and then sometimes this path from here to here is terribly complicated. And you are not given a line, you are given a pair of conflicting images which you have to reconcile, and as you reconcile them, then you get to where you're going. And this, so that this thing here is no longer a unity, but it's a duality. That's the idea he's going to come upon between 1915 and 1928. I think at the beginning of work, you can kind of see that Jung's psychology does develop in time over history the way an analytic process develops over the course of months. But at the beginning, you get a bunch of free lunches. You get just images showing you here you can go, and you walk down that path, and you go, this isn't so bad. And then pretty soon, boom, what it gives you isn't an answer, but another question. And that question has to be wrestled with. That's where then he goes to alchemy to try to understand how that works. He goes to Gnosticism to try to understand how that works. That this thing here is really a polarity. It's really two.
So that father thing would be on the page before where you have the thing in the center going out.
Right.
You'll do the same thing with the father thing.
Right.
You'll go and say it means this, and it means this, and it means this. And then you'll compare this and that to that.
Let me anticipate, since that's where your questions are going. Actually, now he's going to change that word father. And he's going to call this, he doesn't call it this yet, but he's going to call it eventually, he's going to call this the archetype. Of the self. Which is a polarity. And, as I say, often it doesn't appear as a polarity at first. I think it tries to suck you in, you know, like first cigarette's free, and then it's got you. And then it gets really interesting. That is not the father. It is our personality's inborn capacity for image production, which is the archetype.
Say that again.
This is the psyche's, the inner personality's inborn capacity to generate images. So the really correct way to say it, now in light of his later work, and I realize I'm changing what I said, but he will change what he says too, is that it isn't the father. This is the self. It falls back to the self. One of the languages that the self speaks is personal parental images. Another language the self speaks is impersonal images, like sun, fire, torch. Another image that the self speaks is from myth, heroes, heroines. So now, going back to Freud again, where Freud would say, oh, you see, the presence of the father image in this vision shows she has a father problem. And Jung is saying, no, the presence of that father image in her material is because that is the language that the self uses to express itself. It has nothing to do with her father. It's simply that sometimes the self speaks Greek, sometimes it speaks Chinese, sometimes it speaks Latin. One of those languages is parental, one is natural, sometimes it's mythological.
Is there
anything that shows the language? That's a good question. I think probably at the beginning of the process, it's more likely to speak to you in a language that's not going to frighten you. Because, now I'm getting off track a bit, but and anticipating later workshops, but see, this is an image of your individuality. Your individuality is not an average. It's you unique. But that you unique, the more you get to know it, gets to be lonely. Because how do you share you unique with people who are interested in groupthink who live all around you? So at the very beginning of the work, it will tend to use languages, the language that doesn't scare you, that will allow you to still feel rapport with the environment until you become more comfortable with the fact that you are on the path to think differently than everybody else around you. And then the languages become more from myth and more from nature. Yeah.
So would you say that if you're interpreting dreams, or if you're on a road to do in dream interpretation of your own dreams, would you start out maybe dreaming more familiar things?
I think you do,
my
yes.
Father, and then as you get comfortable with those, then you'll get the mythological.
More mythological. Realizing that there are as many exceptions to the rule, but probably on the whole, yes. Right. Yes.
Isn't also, in other words, your own personal history is only so large. And if you've begun to process it, you eventually get to the point where you've settled your own, and then you start moving on to larger collective things.
Yeah. Right. I've anticipated a bit, but I think it's confusing, and you can easily be confused because he starts talking about Father, and you want to process everything through that light. But really, he's not talking about Father. As we go further, he's saying Father is just the language that this other deeper process uses, and then that makes more sense when you see, for you to see how he rejects Freud's saying that the Father is instrumental. For Jung, Father is only the language sometimes, and it does not describe the nature of the energy that's involved. It's simply the language that energy uses.
Also, back to this paragraph 28, this last sentence of there, there was such a tremendous activity of the collective unconscious, it is not surprising that she was finally overcome. It's almost like the self came in and never spoke to her on a personal level, came in on that large, collective level, and just blew her out of the water.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how much, if you've never had a chance to have a personal relationship with the self, then you can be driven crazy.
Oh, absolutely. We'll talk about that all along. That will be, he's going to be talking about now, so what are we going to do about this? But first he's trying to lay out how he understands it, how he differs from Freud in understanding it. Kate?
Can you just remind me, going back to Freud, what was the role of therapy?
To see that this is a substitute, mm-hmm. and that what she really wants is this man. Mm-hmm. Do you have a stretch?
Yeah.